Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll learn more about a lawmaker suing over the governor's stay-at-home order, and we discuss how the pandemic is being viewed in southern Illinois. Contact tracing will be key to reopening society, but some of the technology being developed raises privacy concerns. Also, a Springfield-area long-term care facility has been especially hard hit by the coronavirus, with more than 20 deaths.
That's very emotional for us because it is a struggle. It is tough. We are people. We're human. We love these people.
This week, the community turned out to thank those who put their lives on the line to care for others. We'll have a report. And seeing live theater in person is off limits right now, but that hasn't stopped some groups from taking their performances online. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, cannabis sales have been strong through the pandemic, but there's an issue causing problems for dispensaries. We'll tell you more. Those who work at meat processing plants have some health concerns about the job, and we'll tell you about the impact the coronavirus has had on healthcare workers in Illinois. That's just some of what we have to bring you this hour on Statewide. Polls have shown support for Governor J.B. Pritzker's stay-at-home orders, but one Southern Illinois representative has gained national attention by challenging the governor in court. Republican House Member Darren Bailey from Clay County, a farmer and first-term lawmaker, has brought religious zeal to his fight. Dan Mialopoulos is a reporter for member station WBEZ in Chicago, and he brings us this report.
Pray for the frontline workers, Father God, that you would protect.
Earlier this month, at the end of the, quote, reopen Illinois rally at the state capitol, conservative politician Darren Bailey led the protesters in a prayer slash political speech.
Essential again. Forgive us, Father God, for being quiet too long. Restore us, rescue us, bless us, heal us, bring justice to this property, right?
Bailey is a first-term legislator whose legal challenge to Governor Pritzker also got him on Laura Ingraham's show on the Fox News channel.
Illinois State Rep. Darren Bailey got a judge to strike down Democrat Governor J.B. Pritzker's draconian stay-at-home order. Representative Bailey joins me
for all that attention, the initial ruling from a judge in Clay County applied to Bailey only, and the governor blasted Bailey for it.
This was a cheap political stunt.
Successful or not in his court case, Bailey has tapped into a greater discontent from rural Illinoisans who say the governor's actions impinge on their freedom and liberty. In a phone interview from Louisville, some 240 miles south of Chicago, Bailey told WBEZ his motives were pure.
Darren Bailey, a Christian, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a farmer, and a state representative. I feel like I'm just your typical concerned American patriot.
And Bailey says he just does not understand why more people in this part of the state have not joined him in rebelling against the rules issued during the pandemic.
Well, I don't know. I am terribly alarmed that society will allow, against everything we've ever been taught in our history classes, a person to stand up and say and do and get by with what I've called out as to be, unconstitutional and even illegal activity.
The stay-at-home orders are far from the only issue where Bailey has different views than many people in Chicago. Bailey was a sponsor of legislation to separate Chicago from the rest of the state, and he has said gay marriage is a cause of the, quote, rot in Illinois. Bailey's views also focus on protecting business from government interference. When it comes to government and his own personal business, though, well, Bailey and his family have received more than $2.3 million in federal farm subsidies. Bailey says the farm is 12,000 acres. That's an area bigger than Schaumburg. The Illinois House Republican leader, Jim Durkin, has visited.
I have a great respect for Darren. I have been to his farm. I've been to his region. He represents his constituents well.
But Durkin is from the western suburbs of Chicago, and he supports the governor's order. At the protest in Springfield, there was talk of Bailey running for governor himself. There also were protesters holding up signs featuring swastikas or other Nazi symbols. They drew global condemnation. But Bailey said he did not see those signs, and he does not think they represent the views of any protesters.
That was absolutely not prevalent at all, and I would go so far as to say that very well could have been planted for the photograph.
So how would Bailey describe the protesters?
Americans.
Dan Mihalopoulos, WBEZ News.
The governor this week aimed some criticism at his detractors, Pritzker telling elected leaders he realizes many are struggling to make decisions that could be unpopular.
What I don't have sympathy for is those so intent on disregarding science and logic, so afraid to tell their constituents what they may not want to hear, that they put more people's lives at risk.
The governor says businesses who are licensed by the state could face penalties for violating orders limiting activity. He also says counties who open up in defiance may not be reimbursed by FEMA for damages they cause because they ignored his rules. Let's check in now with Jennifer Fuller. She's the news director at WSIU, the public radio station in Carbondale. And Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
We heard about what Representative Bailey had to say. He said he views the legal fight he's waged, and others too, as a patriotic action. Do a lot of constituents of his and others in the region in southern Illinois share that view?
Oh, sure. You see that around here. I think, though, if you dive deep into what people are really feeling, you find a much more mixed reaction. I think on either end of the spectrum, you've probably got some very vocal groups of people. And then there are people in the middle that are really unsure about what to think. You know, a lot of people saying, well, we can't stay closed forever. But at the same time, we really need to make sure that we're doing things in a smart way and not putting people in danger.
People in Southern Illinois, do you feel overall that they have taken the pandemic seriously? I know there are a lot of people wondering if it's time to move out of some of these restrictions now, but overall, have they been serious about this?
I think they have. You see all over the region, all over the country, where you have some people who don't want to wear a mask or they don't think that they ought to be shut down. So they're doing some things that at least run right up against the recommendations and the government orders, but don't necessarily violate them completely. But at the same time, you still don't see very many people out and about. And when you do, they're being very careful. They're maintaining that 6-foot distance. They're wearing a mask. Things are shut down, so the opportunities are fewer. A lot more people are staying home.
It does strike me that we're seeing a political disagreement with the governor, but we're also seeing some economic issues come into this as well. The governor has said several times he understands the frustration, the concerns, and that people are hurting economically. But from what I have read and heard, a lot of individuals, especially in your area, don't feel that the governor understands their plight. Is that an accurate statement?
That's something that people were saying even before COVID-19 arrived in Illinois and in the United States. As you're well aware, there were movements, you know, bills filed to separate downstate Illinois from the Chicago area, the 5 counties surrounding the Chicago area. So there's always been that Chicago shouldn't be able to run the entire state mentality. But at the same time, there are some people that are saying, no, I'm glad that we have this expertise and a little bit more cushion to make some decisions based on larger populations. Because as with anything, whether it's an economic downturn, a health crisis, those sorts of things, it takes a little bit longer for that to translate to a rural area. On the flip side of that, Southern Illinois already was experiencing among the highest levels of unemployment in the state of Illinois before any of this started. This is only making that dramatically worse. So you have a lot more people who are worried about their health insurance. They're worried about when they're going to be able to put food on the table the next day. We're into the remaining days and weeks of the school year, and a lot of schools in this region, as they are throughout the state, are delivering school lunches to students all over the district. They're not limiting them to students on the free or reduced priced lunch list. They're delivering them to anyone that needs them. And there's a big concern among many social service agencies about what happens when the schools enter that summer break period and suddenly there are families that are really hurting for food.
I'm talking about the economy in that region. Southern Illinois University, especially the Carbondale campus, has had its challenges in recent years with enrollment, and it's an economic engine for that area. How has this pandemic impacted the campus?
You know, right now they're still trying to figure out just what that answer is. That's the top question that the administrators are asked whenever we talk to them. I spoke with the interim chancellor, John Dunn, just earlier this week, and he said that it's just not clear what we're going to see from the state in terms of finishing out this fiscal year and then starting the next fiscal year on July 1st. They're also still working through the money that they're getting from the Federal CARES Act. 50% of the money has to go to students and student aid, and then the other 50% can go toward the operation of the university. At the same time, the university gave back a portion of housing and dining fees to students who didn't return after spring break, and some other things were returned as well. They're not sure. They're teaching online over the summer, and they're not sure what the fall is going to look like. There are some bright points, actually, though, to having a lower enrollment. SIU Carbondale was already offering single rooms to students because they have that capacity in terms of residence halls. That would allow them to have students separate themselves a little bit more than having two or even three people to a room. But it's still not clear whether they'll be able to make that work along with the class sizes work in the fall in order to bring people back.
Well, there are cases of COVID-19 in Southern Illinois, but the number of cases, especially when compared to places like the Chicago region, is a lot lower. From a healthcare standpoint, what are you hearing from, you know, hospitals, doctors, nurses? What are their concerns in that region?
The hospitals and physicians are still prepared for what may be coming. You know, they're operating as if we haven't seen the wave yet. And stockpiling what they can, when they can. We just saw many of the medical facilities in this region, like so many other regions throughout the state, trying to resume some elective surgeries and things like that. We had hospitals and health systems furloughing employees because they weren't doing some of those what's considered non-essential procedures. Well, now they're trying to bring those back to kind of get those hospitals back into some sort of financial footing that's a little bit easier to handle. But I think the most difficult part among all of these is the question mark. The question mark is still the biggest thing that's looming. We don't know what happens tomorrow or even next week.
Well, we know that some of these restrictions the governor has put into place will not be lifted, it appears, before the end of the month, at least, moving to maybe a different phase, as the governor has called it, phase three. That would not open up things like restaurants, but it would allow, you know, hair salons and maybe some office work to resume, getting a little more back to normal. A lot of people in many of the areas outside of Chicago have talked about wanting to see things reopen on a more regional scale. I'm assuming Southern Illinois as well, that people there have wanted to see that happen.
We're hearing from city leaders, county leaders, even some of the legislators in this area that are saying it needs to be a regional approach. They were glad to see the regions that were a part of Governor Pritzker's Restore Illinois proposal, but they wanted them to be even more restricted by geography. So as you may be aware, that map and the way it was divided into four different regions used the Emergency Management Service or system maps. There are 11 districts within that. There are a lot of people here saying, why didn't we just leave it with those 11 districts? Those are put together in similar areas with similar counties. The region that Carbondale is in includes the Metro East, for example, and that's a very different population density than Carbondale, Marion, and other communities within that area.
But some businesses, maybe even some counties and cities, are talking about reopening no matter what the governor has to say. And are you seeing that happening there as well?
Yes, we saw at least one business in Williamson County earlier this week decide, or perhaps it was late last week, decide to go ahead and reopen for dining, not just carry out. They weren't enforcing the mask rule, and they got a call very early from the local health department saying that you're not allowed to do this, we're not going to allow you to do this, and they shut down the dine-in and returned to carry out and delivery orders. You're seeing a little bit of that throughout the region, where local sheriffs, local communities are saying, we're not going to be the ones to enforce this. You're going, you know, if you as a business owner are doing your due diligence and you want to open, we're not going to be the ones to shut you down. They're going to wait for the state police or someone at the state level to make that decision. So that's another place where you see that big unknown. People just aren't sure who has the authority to dictate the rules.
You know, I always tell people when they talk about Southern Illinois that Illinois is a very big state. It's a very long state. And when you're in the southern portion of Illinois, you're actually closer to places like Memphis and Nashville than you are to Chicago. For people that live elsewhere in the state of Illinois, what might they be missing about the attitudes of Southern Illinois?
Well, you certainly see a lot more people that identify, as you said, with places like Memphis or Nashville, Tennessee. Carbondale is actually further south than Louisville, Kentucky. So a lot of people see this part of the state as being a part of the South and its cultures and things like that. But at the same time, they want to remain a part of the state of Illinois. The big thing that you saw from people initially when so much was shut down is that the density of population in southern Illinois is very low. People wanted to be able to go for a walk or enjoy some of the many natural areas that make southern Illinois so different from the rest of the state. Places like Giant City State Park, the Shawnee National Forest, areas like Garden of the Gods, were shut down, and people are saying, but we can socially distance here. We can be outside getting the fresh air and exercise that we need without putting ourselves in danger. And I think that was part of the backlash initially, is that Southern Illinois already knows how to socially distance itself because there are fewer people here.
Jennifer Fuller is the news director of WSIU Carbondale, and she joined us here on Statewide. Jen, thanks once again.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Sean.
Southern Illinois has not escaped the pandemic. This week, it was announced there were cases of COVID-19 showing up at the Anna Veterans Home. Also, Union County, where that home is located, has had a total of at least 100 cases overall of the coronavirus disease. That makes its rate of infection the highest of any county outside of the Chicago area. There's more ahead on Statewide. We'll tell you some of the challenges healthcare workers are facing. Stay with us. And don't forget to check our website at statewideshow.com. You can find links to our stories and our weekly podcast. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, live theater online due to the pandemic. That story and more still ahead. The Illinois General Assembly will return to Springfield for 3 days next week, taking up a spring session workload that's been long delayed by the pandemic. Extraordinary safety measures will govern the May 20th through 22nd session. Lawmakers must pledge to abide by Department of Public Health guidelines to avoid spreading the coronavirus, including pre- and post-session testing. Legislators have canceled most of the spring session. They still have to deal with the budget deficit and put together a budget for the next year. They also hope to provide financial assistance to devastated families and small businesses. A new report from the University of Illinois identifies several ways the COVID-19 pandemic is creating challenges for healthcare workers and facilities. That report is from the Institute for Government and Public Affairs, and it's part of an initiative to convene dozens of faculty experts to study the impact of COVID-19 on the state. Christine Herman spoke with two of the authors of the report, a psychiatrist, Steve Wine, who's director of the Center for Global Health at UIC, and law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson, director of the IGPA.
There's a lot of stress being placed upon workers. They face the risk of infection and actual infection. They face the situation where they may or may not have the equipment that they need to protect themselves. They are worried about going home and infecting their family. They also are put, or maybe fear that they're going to be put in difficult situations where they have to make critical decisions about life-saving measures. They have to be with people who are dying. And some of these things are challenges that healthcare workers always face, but some of them are new. There's also people who are being, you know, reassigned to new kinds of work that they might not have been trained for before. So this is a lot of different levels of change that people are being exposed to. This can add up to a lot of stress. It's the kind of stress that could lead to burnout. It can also lead to traumatization and what we refer to as post-traumatic stress disorder or other kind of mental health problems like depression and anxiety. These are things that all healthcare workers are exposed to all the time, but there's just an increase in the amount of exposure, which means that we have to be looking out for them, and we have to help support healthcare workers by giving them supports and resources that they can care for themselves or that they can get extra help should they need it.
So that's the impact on individuals who work in healthcare. Robin, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected healthcare organizations in Illinois.
You know, if you think for just a moment about your own personal experience, you're getting pinged about telehealth. All of these organizations have rapidly shifted to, for good reason, to providing telehealth services. But that changes the sort of economic model for organizations in ways that I think we haven't completely appreciated. And we're seeing hospitals that had significant reserves absorbing that. They're not furloughing. They're not laying off, you know, their workers. But not every hospital has nearly such flexibility and economic wherewithal to weather it, the immediate hits that they're seeing to their own bottom lines. And one of the things that I think is exciting about the healthcare workforce report is that there are innovations coming out of the Chicago hospitals where they have brought online, for example, temporary housing for workers. And just really, frankly, overnight, a stunning development, a stunning achievement for them to be able to support their workforce in such a concrete, tangible way. One of the things that IGPA has been doing is partnering with other system-wide groups like Illinois Innovation Network, because it has statewide coverage. And we're hoping that some of the innovations that have been piloted at large hospitals with lots of resources can then be transmitted to the state's critical access care hospitals. So that's exciting. You know, we should be able to benefit from the best practices that are being developed in a very difficult time, and especially help those smaller hospitals that don't have the wherewithal or the manpower to try to think through every permutation of this.
That's Robin Fretwell-Wilson, director of the U of I Institute for Government and Public Affairs, and UIC psychiatry professor Steve Wine, speaking with Christine Herman. Live theater in America has been largely shut down for the past 2 months due to the coronavirus outbreak. In central Illinois, theater groups are experimenting with performing online while they wait for the time they can bring actors and audiences together again in the same building. Jim Meadows tells us more.
The Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana hasn't put on a show since early March. The theater, a converted train station, remains dark. But last month, a group of actors found another way to put on a show.
I told you, George, I'm your guardian angel.
Yeah, I know you told me that. What else are you?
This production of It's a Wonderful Life in the format of a radio play was performed in early April, with the cast appearing from their homes via Zoom. You can watch it at the Station Theater's Facebook page. It was director Ed Pierce's idea to restage online the play he had originally produced the regular way last December.
I think everyone was down that the various theater companies in town wouldn't be able to continue, and everyone was looking for a way to continue performing. And then we were able to put this together.
The Celebration Company at the Station Theater is an amateur organization with little debt. Over in the small town of Sullivan, it's a different situation for the nonprofit, professional Little Theater on the Square. They've canceled their summer season due to the coronavirus, which meant also canceling more than 100 seasonal jobs. And Executive Director John Stevens says the Little Theater still has to deal with expenses like the royalties owed for the shows they won't be producing.
So we hope that they'll work with us to move those shows to the future. You know, we have a general overhead here of what it costs a month, and with nothing coming in, that's really hard to face. So it's going to take a lot of our supporters to help to make things be able to stay in place.
At Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, the Theater Arts Department had to cancel stage productions too, and Department Chairman Nicholas Shaw says they also had to figure out very quickly how to teach theater classes online, bringing hands-on instruction to what is essentially a hands-off medium. Shaw says creativity and flexibility were key, such as with the class teaching actors how to prepare for auditioning.
And so the focus of the course switched from a more standard sort of slate, live audition focus to how do you handle a digital audition if that's indeed what the casting agent and the production are asking for. That's a skill that they need anyway.
Back in Champaign-Urbana, a cast of preteens were brought together, virtually anyway, for The Show Must Go Online. Class Act, a local theater studio, produced the short musical comedy from a script quickly issued by a children's theater publisher for groups using video conferencing apps like Zoom. The production made its YouTube premiere May 5th with a cast of 20. Class Act owner Jacqueline Lowenstein says the show provided an important outlet for her students stuck at home.
These are kids who kind of thrive on theater, and they're very dedicated young performers. So to go for this stretch of time, however long it ends up being, without having an outlet like this, I think would be really hard for them.
School is closed, the theater is too. What are the actors supposed to do?
Lowenstein knows what it's like to lose a creative outlet. She was in rehearsals for the musical Falsettos for the Celebration Company at the Station Theater when the production was postponed due to the coronavirus outbreak. Adjusting to that, she says, definitely involved a grieving process. I'm Jim Meadows.
Listening to Statewide. Meat processing plants are now considered essential. That's after President Trump signed an executive order last month requiring them to stay open. But some fear that could mean workers are going into facilities that are ripe for the spread of COVID-19. An outbreak at two plants in the Chicago area forced them to close recently. They're back open now, but as Michael Puente reports, workers are still worried.
It's been nearly 3 weeks since the Smithfield Dry Pork Processing Plant in West Suburban St. Charles was ordered shut by the Kane County Health Department. An outbreak of COVID-19 infections among employees was behind the move. There's been one confirmed case of an employee dying from COVID-19, but the families of two other workers believe their loved ones also died of the disease in the last week. One will be laid to rest today in Kane County, the other tomorrow in Aurora. And while the Smithfield plant has reopened, at least one worker feels afraid to be there.
When I think about that, my stomach hurts.
WBEZ is not identifying this worker because she's fearful she could get fired, but she feels she has no choice but to go into work. We're using the voice of another woman to translate. This worker says hair nets were used as PPE and social distancing recommendations were not followed before the plant temporarily closed.
Well, if I don't go to work, they'll say, okay, then I don't have a job.
The woman has worked at Smithfield for more than two decades. She's originally from Mexico, and most of her co-workers primarily speak Spanish. She's emblematic of those who work in meat processing plants in St. Charles, Chicago, Indiana, and all over the country where coronavirus outbreaks have led to closures, illnesses of nearly 6,000 workers, and at least 20 deaths. And with the pressure to keep these plants open, many workers feel their own health isn't a priority.
She fears working there. She's afraid of going into work.
We told her, boy, you're still positive, so they can't force you to go back. They shouldn't allow you to go back.
Those are the voices of the children of meat processing plant workers who are too afraid to have their own voices heard or names used. A son speaks for his mother who works at OSI and the daughter of a woman who works at Rose Packing, both plants in Chicago. The daughter, Celia, says her mother returned to work this week at Rose Packing despite testing positive for COVID-19 twice. Celia says her mother still feels ill but is being denied another test despite suspicions that her mother may still have the disease.
You're trying to get this lady who's still positive back in there and get everybody sick again. One of the girls at the HR department told her, you shouldn't be opening your mouth. You shouldn't be telling anybody what you have. And I told her, that's not fair. they're not important enough, and they should be, because without them, they would be at a loss.
That's Jesus Rivera, a case manager for Proteus, a program that assists immigrant workers in the Midwest. Rivera says companies aren't doing enough to protect workers either in the farm fields or meat processing plants with a high percentage foreign-born and limited English language skills.
I'm afraid that some of our workers are not speaking up because of retaliation.
At least two Illinois state lawmakers want more done to protect workers, including Representative Karina Villa, whose district includes the Smithville plant.
These three deaths have faces. They have names. They have families. They have loved ones that are missing them right now. St. Charles deserves to know what was done to protect the workers of Smithfield.
Smithfield states it does not comment on COVID-19 cases at its plants. OSI, the parent company of Rose Packing, would not comment on confirmed COVID-19 cases at its plants in Chicago. Both companies spelled out safety measures in place to protect workers as production begins once again. I'm Michael Puente.
Small business owners have been hard hit by the pandemic. Many are turning to the federal government for help through funds like the Paycheck Protection Program. But cannabis dispensaries don't qualify for those loans. And as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, that's putting them in a tough spot.
Like many small business owners, Amy Manganelli has taken a financial hit. So a few weeks ago, she decided to apply for a small business loan from the federal government.
We were turned down. We're a federally illegal business.
Manganelli co-owns a cannabis dispensary called Maple Glen Care Center in Rockford, Illinois. They serve both medical and recreational cannabis users. Dispensaries have been deemed essential in many states with stay-at-home orders and have therefore continued to operate. Manganelli says she's frustrated by the disconnect between the state and federal government.
You quickly realize that you're a legitimate business when it comes to paying taxes. You're not a legitimate business when it comes to any kind of government loan.
Manganelli says she decided on principle at the beginning of the pandemic to prioritize her medical cannabis users. But that's what put her in financial trouble. 60% of her sales come from recreational cannabis. Generally, though, the cannabis industry is doing quite well right now. In fact, Illinois reported sales of marijuana products in April were higher than the two previous months.
This is a really stressful time for everybody, and people are really looking to find relief, whether it's relief from their various conditions, whether it's relief from anxiety, whether it's the ability to sleep, and then are looking for natural ways to find that relief and to medicate.
Tally Wetlaufer is the head of retail for Grassroots Cannabis, which operates dispensaries in 9 states across the Midwest. She says business has been strong over the past couple of months, and they haven't felt the need for help from the federal government. She says they're also accustomed to not having that option.
We are used to operating in sort of a world where we have both some paradoxes with states and the federal government, and don't let that distract us from what our primary purpose is, which is really like serving our customers and patients.
The disconnect between federal and state law, I don't think has ever been as clear as it has been during this period.
John Kagia is the chief knowledge officer with New Frontier Data, which tracks trends across the cannabis industry. He says because dispensaries don't have the same kind of safety net as other small businesses, when times are tough, many turn to their investors. But those investors are having hard times too. However, Kagia says the pandemic has given the industry a legitimate claim to be legalized nationwide.
At a time when the national and indeed the global economy was at its most disrupted, cannabis was considered one of these critical sectors of the economy within the communities which had these industries operational.
He says it'll be hard for officials to discount the importance of the cannabis industry in a post-pandemic world, and that this moment could set the stage for a national debate over cannabis legalization. But for now, small business owners like Amy Manganelli are just hoping to keep their doors open. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
There's still more ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. We'll talk about a lost season for high school sports. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. And coming up, contact tracing may help reopen society. But what about privacy? We'll have that report. It's still ahead. And we're living through the first spring without sports that anyone can remember. Peter Medlin of member station WNIJ spoke to some high school athletes and coaches about their lost season.
Running is more than exercise. It's therapy. That's what Jonah Garcia says. So he's training now harder than ever. Garcia is a senior distance runner on Auburn High School's track and field team in Rockford. Like so many spring athletes, Jonah had his final high school season stolen by the COVID-19 pandemic. He says he was feeling good about the season and had personal records he figured he could easily break.
I was hoping to go D1 and maybe try and get a scholarship based off of my times this year.
But luckily, this isn't the end for Garcia. He'll be running at Iowa Central Community College next year. And running and talking to his coaches and teammates has been a salve, he says, as his high school journey winds down in the most unpredictable way possible.
Basically, people are saying just something along the lines of control that which you can control.
Many spring athletes aren't continuing to the collegiate level. They took their last swings and ran their last lap without knowing it. Neil Bertram says he had a hard time holding it together when he found out games would be canceled. He's been the baseball coach at Rockford Lutheran for 35 years.
So we were in the middle of practice and kind of was stunned when I got the message.
It's a bit harder to keep practicing baseball in quarantine. Bertram hopes it's at least bringing families closer and giving his players time to reflect.
They've had a chance to maybe play catch more with their dad.
Or maybe they've had time to watch old games and appreciate the history of their sport while current pro games are canceled. Cyrus Wimberly has been sending his players training drills from YouTube. He's the baseball coach at Jefferson High School in Rockford. The Jayhawks had just handed out uniforms and taken team pictures when the news rolled out.
The train was getting ready to get going. You know, we were getting ready for the season to start.
Now, he knows the IHSA tournaments are canceled, but he's still wondering if he and his team should hold on to hope that there could be games of some kind this summer. It's not clear yet.
The communication, you know, like it's been a little off and on, but you know, that's what's going on in the world right now.
Many schools are figuring out ways to honor their seniors. They participate in the Lights for the Fight initiative. Every Friday night, schools turn on their lights at the athletic field to show support for senior athletes, as well as essential workers and first responders. Katie Barnett is the girls' soccer coach at Guilford High School in Rockford. Their players all got team jackets, and the Vikings handed out yard signs, too.
We had probably the most talent coming into this season that we've had in as long as I can remember.
Barnett says she struggled with how much hope she should give her team about possible games. Both Barnett and Neil Bertram say they didn't want to overwhelm their teams while the students have their e-learning to work on, too. So Barnett says she's talked to her girls over texts and given them lighthearted reminders of where the season would be.
You know, when we play Freeport, I'm like, eat a bag of pretzels today.
They've also been virtually celebrating college signings on their team. Olivia Zedeker is one of the seniors. She'll also be playing soccer at the next level.
It was definitely heartbreaking. Now it's like I'm letting go of that part of me without like a proper goodbye, if that makes sense.
Zedeker says she and her friends on the team have instead tried to focus on the good times over the last 3 years of soccer. While the IHSA hasn't made any official changes to fall sports, it's something athletic directors like Rockford's Matt Parker are considering.
There certainly could be significant provisions in place to have smaller crowds and smaller audiences.
Those measures mirror proposals of what professional sports could look like when they come back. Parker says he and his colleagues are thinking about what games they could televise or stream online if large groups are still prohibited. Cyrus Wimberly at Jefferson is thinking about the day he and his team gets to step back onto the diamond. He says they won't take it for granted.
And I think that's how athletes should approach every game is, hey, this is my last game, you know, because, again, some kids, some high school kids, they might not get that chance.
And he says whenever that game comes, even if it's just an ordinary high school exhibition, for the team, it's going to feel like the Super Bowl. I'm Peter Medlin.
A select number of Illinois state parks reopened on a limited basis earlier this month. Some park amenities like beaches, camping, and turkey hunting are still suspended. Only 2 people are allowed per boat. Colleen Callahan is director of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. She says visitors have been mostly respectful, and they haven't had many issues with groups or garbage. She says people are appreciating the physical and mental benefits the parks can offer, especially when options are limited under the stay-at-home order. But it's still important to stress social distancing. And she says if you feel sick, stay home.
It's unnatural for us to say in
in the same sentence, enjoy the great outdoors, go visit a park, and then say this is about life and death all at the same time. And right now it is.
Callahan's department is working with Governor Pritzker and the Department of Public Health to set safety criteria to continue the phased reopenings of state parks. As of now, it's uncertain when or where more state parks could open if parts of the state reach the next phase of the reopening plan. So-called murder hornets arrived in North America for the first time last year, and they've garnered public attention in recent weeks, but some local experts say they don't pose as much of a threat as it seems. Lesha Bushak has more.
The giant hornets are native to Asia and were initially spotted in Washington state last year, but it's unlikely the insects will spread outside of Washington to pose any real threat. That's according to Adam Dolezal with the University of Illinois Department of Entomology.
The chances of us having the hornets at all are pretty minimal. The chances of them impacting most people's day-to-day lives is pretty minimal. But there are other invasive insect pests that are much more economically damaging, to me, are much scarier. And, you know, we don't hear about them near as much.
Some of those invasive pests include the spotted lanternfly and Asian citrus psyllid. Dolezal says if the hornets do spread, they could pose some risk to honeybees. But he says pesticides, a shift in land use, and reduced bee nutrition pose a far greater threat to bee populations than the hornets. I'm Lesha Bushak.
Illinois wants hundreds to potentially thousands of contact tracing workers trained and ready to start tracking the spread of the new coronavirus by the end of this month. At the same time, big tech companies are developing technology that could help with tracing efforts. Sam Dunklaw has our Illinois Issues report. He takes a look at what's at stake for Illinois residents as the worlds of technology and public health collide.
You probably have heard a lot about contact tracing in the last few weeks, but let's review. Contact tracing is a public health strategy that's been around for a long time, and policymakers say it's crucial to getting COVID-19 outbreaks under control. Trained workers are tasked with investigating the spread of a given disease. They get in touch with anyone an infected person may have been in contact with. They let those people know they may have been exposed, so they can then take steps to prevent further spreading the disease. Now, that's how traditional contact tracing works, but two tech companies say they want to boost traditional efforts by doing what they do best.
Enter Google and Apple, who are teaming up in an unprecedented partnership to create a contact tracing tool of their own.
In May, they'll push new software to all Android and iOS devices, allowing Bluetooth signals to track if a phone's been in close proximity to someone who's infected.
Here's how it would work. Users would be given the choice to allow their phones to emit a randomized Bluetooth ID to all phones within a certain distance. If two users are close to each other for 5 minutes or more, the app records what happened. Then, if any of those people test positive for COVID-19, they let the app know and it'll alert those they came in contact with. This could be a game changer for contact tracing, right? Well,
you're talking about Apple and Google and potentially these apps and government regulators tracking people, and kind of how does that play with current laws and also just the uneasiness that people feel right now.
That's Jacob Wright, who directs the public policy arm of Edelson PC Law Firm in Chicago. He's an expert in data privacy, which is perhaps the biggest sticking point of this new app. Apple and Google didn't respond to requests for comment for this story, but they have told users the current app design never reveals any identifiable info and that the data it collects is never stored on a central server. But as Wright points out, users have to take the developers at their word.
They're basically the gatekeepers of their policies, right? So they're saying a lot of things that seem good and are good from a privacy perspective, but it's also up to them to enforce it.
Why this matters so much in Illinois is that we already have some pretty strong data privacy laws. The Personal Information Protection Act, for example, outlines measures companies have to follow to keep personal info secure. And then there's the Biometric Information Privacy Act, or BIPA, which requires firms to get a user's informed consent before using things like fingerprints. On top of the legal roadblocks, there's another element to this that's key. Will anyone want to use this app?
It's also, I think, an acknowledged truth about a lot of public health efforts that if they're not voluntary, in many cases, you can defeat the original purpose.
Stacey Gray of the Future of Privacy Forum says if Apple and Google's tech is going to be successful here, or anywhere, somewhere between 60 and 80% of phone users have to agree to use it. The only way that happens, Gray says, is if both companies make a pledge.
If you can just say this data will not be used for advertising, any commercial purposes at all, immigration, law enforcement, that it's going to be siloed off and only used for public health purposes. I think that would go a long way.
Now, the Illinois legislature could pass a law and require companies to make that promise. But Democratic Representative Ann Williams of Chicago, who's spearheaded data privacy efforts, says even now that might be a big hurdle.
The companies have been unwilling to accept even the most basic regulation and have opposed very simple bills in Springfield to notify consumers that their data was being collected and tracked. So this is a pretty big deal for people.
Williams and others are in agreement about one thing. If Apple and Google see this app through, it would be a tool for, rather than a replacement of, Illinois contact tracers.
Any tool that we can use and find to mitigate the damage is useful and is worth exploring. I'm just saying that these privacy considerations have to be a part of that conversation.
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Residents of the town of Sherman, near Springfield, showed their support this week for a long-term care facility in the town that's struggling with an outbreak of COVID-19. Mary Hansen filed this report.
Ken Tassett stands up a 3-foot cardboard sign in the bed of his pickup truck, painted with "We support you and we love you."
Any of the staff members and the first responders and so forth, they just step up to the plate, and I really admire those people that do that.
Tassett is a board member for The Villas, the long-term care facility in Sherman, where an outbreak of coronavirus has sickened at least 60 residents and 40 employees.
Well, it's unfortunate that it happened at this one, but it could happen at any one of them.
As cars begin to line up in Sherman's park off Business 55, Sean Moser is walking up and down the line, handing out little yellow hearts that read, "Pray for The Villas."
I'm a director at an intermediate care facility for developmentally disabled men. And we know the struggles of what it is to battle something like this.
Moser is director of Brother James Court in Springfield. He says his facility hasn't had any coronavirus cases, but has been preparing and taking precautionary measures.
We want to make sure that we're free of it, but we also want to show our support for people or other organizations that are going through it.
By the time we finish talking, dozens and dozens of vehicles have pulled in. A few have painted "Villas Strong" and "Thank You" on their windows. It seems like the entire town is showing up, and that makes sense.
I just can't demonstrate it through words how much the Villas mean to the people of the village of Sherman.
Trevor Klatfelter is president of the village's board. He says the Villas is an economic engine, yes, providing more than 100 jobs to care for the 80 residents, but there's more.
We're here for them. They've always been here for us.
Klatfelter says since the stay-at-home order went into effect, he's been working with residents and the police department to organize birthday parades for kids who can't have parties. So when he heard morale was low at the nursing home...
So this is one way that we can stay safe, stay away from the Villas, and show support and bring happiness and joy.
And with a police escort leading the couple hundred cars that have gathered, the parade makes its way to the entrance of the Villas. There, staff in scrubs and masks are waiting. The cars drive by slowly, and kids and adults shout their thanks and encouragement. It takes about 20 minutes for all the cars to pass, and includes vehicles from Mill Creek, the Villas of Holybrook, and other nursing homes from around the area. Sharon Reynolds, the administrator for the Villas, is awed by the number of people who showed up. She says Brother James Court, among other facilities, have been very supportive.
They have been so good to us. They feed us meals during the day. They bring our residents spiritual books and crossword puzzles and things that, you know, would make them happy.
She says caring for residents in the midst of an outbreak has been challenging.
That's very emotional for us because it is a struggle. It is tough. We are people. We're human. We love these people.
More than 20 residents have died from COVID-19 in the last few weeks. Reynolds says staff and residents haven't had time to grieve.
We will have at some point when we can all be together where we can actually hug each other. We want to do a ceremony, you know, to honor those people as well.
For now, the joy the parade brings won't just stay with those who were able to stand outside and watch.
We will go in now and we will show all our residents those videos, and they'll love that. They will love it.
Reynolds says before the parade, they asked residents to make the posters hanging in the windows of the home. One reads, "Half staff plus half residents equals one family."
We will heal It'll take a long time, but we know we are so committed to this public.
I'm Mary Hansen.
That wraps up this episode of Statewide. If you missed any of this week's show or past shows, you can find them at statewideshow.com. Our podcast is also available each week through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. In the meantime, stay safe. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.